CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Conley and Jeff Sargent.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, a new program at UBC is taking steps to combat the rising number of STIs in Canada.
And the argument continues between the Musqueam First Nation and the Vancouver Park Board over who gets what on the UBC campus.
And on commentary, in the second part of a two-part series, Phil Caudry discusses the Democratic presidential nomination race, where according to all leading U.S. polling firms, Hillary Clinton is the clear frontrunner to win the nomination.
We'll have all this, plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour, right here on News 101.
UBC is trying out a one-year program to encourage safe sex among students. They plan to give away 25,000 condoms at both the UBC Wellness Center and the Student Health Services Clinic. The program comes as a response to the growing rates of sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, in Canada during the past 10 years. Researchers say that many people know they should use condoms, but still choose not to. Organizers of the program say that they aim to make condoms more accessible for students. Now with a look at other local news, here are Leanne Yu and Carrie Baptist.
Vancouver city officials are thinking about banning smoking on restaurant patios, near building entryways, air intake vents, and windows. The BC Restaurant Association feels that such a ban would not drastically affect restaurant business. President Ian Tonstenson says that several restaurant groups have actually gone smoke-free, including the Cara Group that owns Milestones Restaurant, and he believes their guests have appreciated the move. Tonstenson says there is a general trend towards people not smoking and, as he says, doing the right thing, so he believes that implementing the smoking ban on a larger scale will not encounter problems as one may think.
The Vancouver City Council is considering outlawing ultimate fighting after a new British Medical Association study concluded that this sport can cause serious brain injury. In ultimate fighting, opponents can use various fighting techniques, including mixed martial arts, in order to win. It is very popular in Vancouver, with tickets going for as much as $200 for an elite fight. Currently, it is regulated by the city's Athletics Commission, but this commission is unsure if it still wants to support the sport, given its serious health risks.
Grouse grinders hoping to torture themselves next week will have to find someplace else to work their quadriceps. The Grouse Grind Trail, affectionately known as Mother Nature's Stairmaster, will be closed for a 36-hour safety upgrade. The closure will take place from 6 p.m. on Monday to about 7 a.m. on Wednesday. North Vancouver RCMP officers will be guarding the trail. Those attempting to gain access to the trail will be turned away. Workers will be clearing rocks from the 2.9-kilometer climb, which sits on Grouse Mountain debris fan. The ground underneath and surrounding the trail has been known to be unstable.
Picture waking up in the middle of the night and finding a stranger walking around in your bedroom. It sounds like a scene from a movie, but that's what some Abbotsford residents have had to go through lately. Abbotsford Police Constable Casey Vinay is warning people to lock their windows before going to bed, even if they live in second or third floor apartments. He says burglars are becoming bolder and are no longer just sticking to rummaging in living rooms. 35 overnight break-ins have occurred in the Abbotsford area since June. The incidents have occurred about half and half in houses and apartments. Vinay says police have already arrested some people of interest in relation to the break-ins. However, since the invasions are still occurring, police know they are dealing with more than one suspect.
Controversy has erupted over treaty negotiations involving the UBC golf course. NPA Commissioner Marty Zlotnick recently put forth the Musqueam First Nation get land from the Pacific Spirit Park instead of the originally proposed UBC golf course in a treaty negotiation with the province. While the suggestion has angered many, COPE Commissioner Loretta Woodcock says NPA Chair Ian Robertson has refused to put forth a motion opposing Zlotnick's idea for next Monday's meeting. Woodcock says that people are very upset by the idea of removing land from Pacific Spirit Park, and she says many have begun contacting the Vancouver Park Board commissioners looking for answers. Meanwhile, Ian Robertson says he hasn't made any final decisions about the motion. He says while he doesn't support the idea of taking land away from the park, he does respect Zlotnick's opinion. The Vancouver Park Board will become involved if a proposal comes before the Parks Committee, but for now, the park is under Metro Vancouver's jurisdiction. All right, we're going to take a quick break now, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
dem nu og æske nej.
Martin Noino.
Yellow man, king of the dancer.
Everybody know that, you know.
Stamp it.
Take it to the limit. Rough boy. Yeah.
I put on the ring. On Friday, September 14th, CITR Radio presents King Yellow Man.
Give me another try. I'll make it satisfied.
Lord of mercy. Zungo, zungo, go, zungo, zen.
King Yellow Man and his Sagittarius band, with special guest Dub Freak, Friday, September 14th at the Commodore Ballroom. Tickets at Highlight, Zulu, Salon Supreme, Rehana's Roti, Piazza Hairdressing Salon, and Ticketmaster.
Yellow Man, king of the dancer.
Everybody know that, you know.
Stamp it!
UBC Rec is everything that is recreation on campus. No matter how you play, UBC Rec is your resource for fun activities. This student program is operated by over 140 volunteers, and it is the largest intramural recreation organization in Canada. Programs cover fitness, instructional classes, outdoor recreation, drop-in sports, special events, small tournaments, and intramural leagues. All the registration information is available in the Student Recreation Center or online at rec.ubc.ca. UBC Rec, how do you play?
bcsportsbeat.ca is your source on the internet dedicated to providing you with information on professional and amateur sports in your province. You'll find game scores, team updates, and the perspective of the athletes through in-depth interviews all at bcsportsbeat.ca. bcsportsbeat.ca, your source for BC Sports.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:12. Now we take a look at other BC news, and we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Tracy Fuller and Leslie Young.
The Fraser Health Authority is warning travelers to South Asia about the risk of typhoid fever. Cases of typhoid have tripled in the Fraser Valley over the past 6 years. Last year alone, there were 28 reported cases, a large jump from the 9 cases reported in 2000. More than 80% of these cases have come from people traveling to India without being vaccinated first. Dr. Eleni Galanis is with the BC Centre for Disease Control, says a very good vaccine is available at any travel clinic for $40. Typhoid is contracted by consuming foods contaminated with feces from an infected person. Diarrhea and fever are among its symptoms. Galanis says many people infected with typhoid are visiting a place where they once had an immunity from it. However, after living in Canada for months or years, the immunity is lost.
Ambulance users can expect to pay more starting October 1st, as the provincial government is raising the cost of an ambulance trip under 40 kilometres from $54 to $80. Health Minister George Abbott believes the price increase to be a positive change that will eliminate fees for rural British Columbians, who until now were charged per kilometre for ambulance services, with the potential for another hospital transfer fee. NDP health critic Adrian Dix disagreed with the measure. Dix said it was beyond him why a government with a $4 billion surplus needed to impose a 50% tax increase on middle-income and sick British Columbians.
According to the 2006 census figures, more young adults in British Columbia are living at home than ever before. Over 44% of British Columbians between the ages of 20 and 29 said that they lived at home, representing an 18% increase over the past two decades. UBC sociologist James White says that a number of factors are contributing to this new trend, especially the high cost of housing in the province. White says that the cultural practices of our large immigrant population and the simple convenience of living with one's parents are also factors in this increase.
BC Finance Minister Carol Taylor says the next provincial budget will focus on the environment. This after issuing a first quarter financial report forecasting economic growth over the next 2 years. The budget surplus for this year has jumped from $1.6 billion, up from $400 million last year. Taylor says BC's economy has been able to stand strong, despite what she calls the financial storm taking place in the United States. With a large surplus in the budget, Taylor is asking the public for ideas on how the province can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. She recently appeared on a CBC radio call-in program, asking callers for their ideas on the budget. Despite the public consultation, NDP finance critic Bruce Ralston is unimpressed. He noted that 2 years ago, the provincial budget focused on children, but says that BC now has the worst child poverty rates in Canada. Ralston says last year's budget focused on housing, but points out that BC has the least affordable housing in the country. He is concerned that Taylor's interest is in finding ways to work on environmental problems is nothing more than hollow promises. We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Join us on September 20th to celebrate the launch of A Matter of Taste, Ceramics and Culinary Connections, a new guided tour linking the amazing variety of food and drink-related ceramics in the Kerner Ceramics Gallery with the unique history of the cuisine they once contained.
The launch includes introductory remarks by ceramics curator Dr. Carol Mayer, a talk by celebrated food historian and author Dr. Ken Albala, period music by Lark in the Evening, and samples of early, modern European cuisine.
This is a public event, but pre-registration is required. To register, please call reception at 604-822-5087. Admission is free for all UPC staff, students, and faculty. For more information, please visit www.moa.ubc.ca.
A lot of niggas wish to die. You need to holy horses. There's bigger fish to fry. You're on the list. If not, pick a number spot. 10.5 Tim's is made to kick your bumper clock.
The Leo Ramirez Show. The best mix of Latin American music, news, sport, and commentary from around the local and international Latin American communities. Saturday, 5 to 6 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. El show de Leo Ramírez, la mejor mezcla de música, noticias, deportes y comentarios de la comunidad latinoamericana. Sábado de 5 a 6 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM CITR.
I'm Peter Mansbridge and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
5:18 and the news continues on CITR. Canada has neglected to sign the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, much to the dismay of this country's First Nations leaders. With more on that story, here's Leanne Yu.
The international community has adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, despite opposition from Canada and other countries. This non-binding declaration describes human rights standards for Indigenous peoples, including rights to self-determination, language, and land. Canada was one of only four countries to vote against the declaration, leading Canadian Aboriginal and Northern leaders to express disappointment with Canada's refusal to sign. Assembly of First Nations Chief Phil Fontaine has said that this action has harmed Canada's reputation as a protector of human rights. Indian and Northern Affairs Minister Chuck Strahl commented that the United Nations declaration lacks clear guidance for implementation and conflicts with the existing Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which the government believes already protects the rights of Aboriginals.
Quebec Premier Jean Charest announced Friday that schools in the province will eliminate soft drinks and fatty foods starting in January. Mr. Charest told a news conference in Montreal Friday that it will not cost more to offer better food at a reasonable price. He said he also wants schools to attack what he calls an obesity problem. Charest stated that schools have to offer healthy foods and exercise, and parents need information to make the right choices for their children. Mr. Charest announced that his Liberal government will add $11 million to an existing $5 million program to allow schools to develop programs for exercise and healthy food choices.
Residents of a Canadian military base during the Vietnam War era that were exposed to the Agent Orange are receiving some long overdue compensation from the Canadian government. Residents that lived in or near the Gagetown, New Brunswick base from 1966 to 67 were exposed to nearly 350 kilograms of the deforestation chemical when it was tested on a remote corner of the base by the U.S. government for its effectiveness in eliminating enemy tree cover. Those residents exposed to the chemical have developed conditions such as spina bifida and prostate cancer. The Canadian government has set aside $96 million to cover nearly the 4,500 affected by the chemical, and in addition, a class action lawsuit against the government and the chemical manufacturers has begun.
And government agencies are taking steps to gain personal information about telephone and internet customers without obtaining a court order. Public Safety Canada and Industry Canada are currently holding a consultation on how law enforcement and national security agencies can gain access to telecommunication customers' personal information. Information in questions includes names, addresses, phone numbers, as well as email addresses and IP addresses, which can be used to locate a computer's location. The agencies defend the consultation because under current processes, enforcement agencies have experienced difficulties in gaining the information from service providers. Some service providers have been demanding a court-issued warrant before turning over the data. Concerned privacy advocates say that without judicial oversight, government access to personal information raises privacy issues.
And in international news, a proposed free trade agreement between many of our nation has got many of our nation's labor unions and citizens groups in staunch opposition. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
This internal free trade accord, the Trade Investment and Labor Mobility Agreement, has raised concerns nationally amongst labor unions that view the initiative as an attempt to adjust labor standards to the lowest common denominator. These cross-country harmonizations remove the abilities of municipal and provincial governments to introduce their own local labor and environmental standards. Aaron Weir is an economist with the Canadian Labor Congress.
Well, our main concern with the agreement is that it gives business a great deal of latitude to directly challenge public policies by suing for up to $5 million over alleged violations by provincial governments, municipalities, and school boards. So our concern really is that it's going to drive a lot of public interest regulation down to the lowest common denominator.
Similar to the controversial Chapter 11 of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, corporations under the proposed regulations in TILMA will have the ability to sue public institutions and governments over claimed lost profit that could occur due to local or environmental standards or regulations. All major labor unions across Canada are opposed to the agreement and see it as an attempt to undermine public policy and Canada-wide labor standards. The proposed legislation, although implemented in certain provinces, has not been brought forward in any national or provincial government body, only discussed in closed-door sessions between corporate leaders and Canada's Conservative government. Lynn Gorman, with the Council of Canadians in Edmonton, says TILMA would have a broad impact.
It will downgrade the standards, which can impact the health and the safety issues of our working people. So that is a huge fear. The problem with TILMA is that in the first article it says there shall be no undue barrier to trade, investment, or labor mobility. And it was signed without any public consultation in either province.
Opponents to the agreement directly link proposed TILMA policies to economic integration efforts under the Security and Prosperity Initiative, the SPP, a trilateral trade and security initiative in North America. Canada's proposed internal trade accord is indicative of policies pushed through the SPP, in that the agreement, according to its critics, attempts to drive down labor standards to the lowest common denominator in order to secure greater profits. Stuart True is a researcher with the Council of Canadians in Ottawa.
The
nature of these agreements like TILMA and the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the nature of the kind of regulatory harmonization is designed specifically to benefit corporate interests and not the public as we see it. What we've seen in the United States and in Canada is a trend towards deregulation. You know, this idea that the pressure is always to liberate markets, right, and to liberate trade and to reduce regulations and reduce barriers. You know, it's not to make our food safer or our environment less hazardous. And that's our problem with these agreements like TILMA.
In this light, labor unions across Canada remain skeptical of the potentially national trade investment and labor mobility agreement. Marvin Mikel is with the Saskatchewan Federation of Labor.
The agreement itself is a brutal attack against democracy. There have been ongoing negotiations and discussions at the government level, the highest level of government. The agreement came into effect April 2006. Most people in those two provinces woke up and didn't know that morning that their democracy had been sold.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Stefan Christophe in Montreal.
And our thanks to Stefan Christophe from Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available for rebroadcast. Denmark is inviting Canada, the United States, Norway, and Russia to a conference next year to discuss their rival claims to the North Pole. Danish Foreign Minister Per Stig Møller says he is sending invitations to the foreign ministers of all five Arctic superpowers. A foreign affairs spokesperson says no decision has been made about whether Canada will attend. The five countries are trying to assert sovereignty in the Arctic region, where a U.S. study suggests as much as 25% of the world's undiscovered oil and gas could be hidden. The race has heated up lately as Russia sent two small submarines to plant a tiny national flag under the North Pole last month. Canada has announced plans to build a new army training center and a deep water port in the north as a method of exerting its sovereignty. All right, it's time now for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
Thunderstorms, see the lightning flashing. Thunderstorms.
Thank you for stopping that. If you actually want to learn more about weather, join the UBC Storm Club. For more information, email us at stormubc@gmail.com. Stop playing those cheesy songs and tune into News 101 Mondays and Fridays for your CITR weather forecast.
CITR podcast update number one.
Work has begun on Canada's Information Highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. Without getting too technical, tell me how what you're working on is different from what's available to me right now.
So right now, if you want to listen to your favorite CITR program, you need to be listening to it on your radio live or streaming over the internet live. But with CITR podcasts, you'll be able to download your favorite show and listen to it whenever you want on your computer or on your MP3 player.
I'm just thinking about that.
I know, it's pretty rad.
For more information, visit CITR.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening and please be kind to robots.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. It's 5:28 and it's now time for commentary. While many experts believe a Clinton nomination in the race for the U.S. Democratic leadership is at this stage an inevitability, Phil Caudry discusses why this may not be the case and which candidates are most likely to supplant Clinton as the nomination's frontrunner in the coming months.
While the Republican presidential nomination, which I discussed last week, remains wide open with plenty of fluctuation in the polls, the polar opposite can be said about the Democratic race. For the last 4 months, Senator Hillary Clinton has continued to solidify her stranglehold in the polls. Clinton leads with approximately 40% of Democratic support, following in a distant second place is Senator Barack Obama at around 22%. Former 2004 vice presidential nominee John Edwards rounds out the top three with about 13% in support. These numbers, cited by many leading U.S. polling firms, have remained so stable that some experts believe a Hillary Clinton victory is an inevitability. While the polling reveals Clinton has a substantial lead, a lot can change with the months preceding the first primaries in January. Democrats will choose the most electable candidate to return the White House back into their hands. Most political parties do. So while Clinton may have the name recognition and rock star status among Democrats, their confidence in her ability to take the White House is behind other contenders. If Clinton wins the White House in 2008, she will be the president with the highest disapproval ratings in history. She's a very polarizing figure, and roughly 45% of Americans have an unfavorable impression of her. Unless there is a major change in perception of Clinton by December, I can't imagine her winning the nomination. John Edwards is currently leading in polls in the early primary of Iowa, and South Carolina is a close three-way race between Clinton, Obama, and Edwards. If Clinton loses these two early primaries, her campaign is likely over. So who has the best chance of winning the nomination? Similarly to last week, I have a top-tier and a dark horse candidate in mind that are most likely to clinch the nomination. John Edwards consistently does best among Democrats in polls that match Democratic candidates against their Republican rivals. Currently, no Republican is statistically tied or ahead of Edwards. He is almost as universally known as Clinton, but is much more favorably viewed as he does not have the polarizing effect Clinton has on the American public. Unfortunately, race and gender are still issues of contention in American politics. The fact that John Edwards is the only top-tier candidate who is a white male is advantageous for him. As well, he has a regional advantage being from the South, as picking up Southern Electoral College votes is critical to electoral victory. His populist message is also resonating well in the Midwest, where many of the swing states are located. I believe if Edwards wins the nomination, his momentum will be unstoppable, and he will be the next president of the United States. The dark horse candidate that has a good shot of taking the nomination is my personal pick, Governor Bill Richardson. Richardson currently rounds out the second tier of Democratic candidates. He is gaining ground in the critical early primary of Nevada, and is placing in the top three in Iowa polls. He is the only Democratic candidate with executive experience in his role as governor. Governors tend to be more favorable as candidates as they often do not have such a vast voting record to defend as members of the Congress. So far, Richardson has made a handful of minor gaffes, and his performance has been inconsistent in debates. However, Richardson is still managing to move up in the polls and is learning from his mistakes. If he improves enough this fall, when the candidates are given a long look by voters, he could have enough momentum to peak at just the right time. With his international experience as an ambassador and as a chief negotiator with many dictators around the globe, Richardson will likely shore up more support in the coming months. Being a candidate of Mexican heritage and being fluent in Spanish should help him with the Hispanic voting bloc once voters begin to look at candidates beyond Clinton, Edwards, and Obama. Either candidate the Democrats end up choosing, they are blessed with an incredible crop of candidates that will all be competitive. Even their worst candidates pull competitively against leading Republican candidates. There are bright days ahead for the Democratic Party. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Cottery.
And thanks for that, Phil. And now I'm going to turn things back over to Katie Calmly here with a brief introduction to our oddity of the week.
Thanks, Jeff. And this week, for a bit of a change from our regular oddity, we once again have our foreign correspondent, Peter Otis, reporting from Copenhagen. And this week, Peter takes a look at the lighter side of life in Copenhagen with a critical examination of how the Danish like to party.
Danes are shy, quiet people, I was told before arriving in Copenhagen. It's not that they're cold, I was warned, it's just that they hate to stick out in a crowd. Well, on early Sunday morning, my neighborhood of Nørrebro got to see a very different side of this society. You see, September 1st marked the six-month anniversary of Denmark's biggest riot in recent history. And what better way to celebrate than with another riot? Starting at midnight.
Now wait a minute. You know you make me wanna
shout, shout, let it all out.
Yo, on Tuesday, October 2nd, 2007, CITR 101.9 FM and the UBC AMS presents That DJ Competition at the Pit. And we want you to spin. So here's the download. It's quite simple. Eight DJs play 15-minute sets each with a minimum of three genres of music to keep the party popping. There are no restrictions on what audio sources or what musical style the DJ chooses to use. DJs must bring their own music and needles and provide their own transportation. The equipment provided will be properly functioning, professional, quality equipment. Interested? Then send your demo to That DJ Competition, CITR Radio, 233-6138 Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1. Along with your full name, emailing address, mailing address, home, cell phone number, your musical style, and audio sources used. MySpace submissions are also accepted. Please send them to thatdjcompetition2007@gmail.com. For more information, please visit our website at www.citr.ca or email thatdjcompetition2007@gmail.com.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley alongside Jeff Sargent coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Right now it is 5:35, and it's time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Art Spot. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. Today I have a review of Bard on the Beach's Romeo and Juliet by my friend and arts volunteer, Colette Johns. This is timely as Bard on the Beach is now in its final weeks, wrapping up at Vanier Park on September 24th. If you're planning on checking out Romeo and Juliet before the festival closes, this review may change your mind. But I'll let you judge for yourselves. The following is Colette Johns' review, read by myself. I've been to the Bard on the Beach Shakespeare Festival before. I enjoyed the view out of the open-ended tent of the beautiful backdrop that is the waterfront of Vanier Park, and enjoyed each moment of A Midsummer Night's Dream. This year, I had high expectations for the company's performance of the highly popular Romeo and Juliet. As always, the unchanged backdrop was magical. It's a beautiful scene of clear blue sky and mountains across the water, and someone managing to fly a kite from the beach. Once the actors were on stage, I got drawn in by the chilling prologue with little resistance, and began to anticipate a thrilling and passionate performance of Romeo and Juliet. The first scene kept the excitement of the prologue with its aggressive sword fighting, accompanied by amusing insults between the feuding Capulet and Montague families. Then, we meet Romeo. He is a little underwhelming in appearance and performance. I want so badly for him to say something with conviction to redeem himself, but I find him a bit bland, and he barely commands as much attention as the eye-catching kites flying in the background. With Romeo out of the way, the nurse and Mercutio steal the show from their first scenes. These two characters are the comic relief of the tragedy, and while delivering their quips and sometimes hardly subtle innuendos, they truly command the stage. It comes as no surprise that Mercutio plays the lead in the festival's headlining play, The Taming of the Shrew. Once Juliet is allowed to come out of the shadow of a high-energy nurse, she blossoms into someone we can love and believe. Unfortunately, I find myself picturing her with Mercutio rather than with her soft-spoken, lethargic Romeo, and I become indifferent to their initial meeting and the hasty marriage that follows. I finally see the passionate performance from Romeo I was waiting for in Act 2 as he yells in agony about his banishment from Mantua and Juliet. But by that time, I find it to be too little too late, and it's only intermission. When the figurative curtain rolls back up, I am a little more resistant to be pulled back into the story. By this time, Mercutio is dead, and the nurse has little to say after her beloved Juliet appears to have died in her sleep. Therefore, the rest seem to be nothing more than an unengaging blur of confusion and death, resulting in the consecutive suicides of the two young lovers. Although the cast was hugely talented, the actors in the title roles couldn't keep me engaged for the entire depressing work. If I go back to Bard on the Beach again, I think I'll stick to comedies, maybe something with a death toll under three. And that's your Bard on the Beach review by Colette Johns, covering the legendary Romeo and Juliet. Remember that Bard on the Beach is also showing The Taming of the Shrew, Julius Caesar, and Timon of Athens. It's running until September 24th at Vanier Park. Here are the rest of this week's arts listings. The Arts Club presents a musical comedy by Stephen Sondheim and George Firth called Company. It's the story of a Manhattan bachelor considering matrimony, and it runs till October 14th at the Stanley Industrial Alliance stage. Theatre UBC presents William Shakespeare's darkly comic play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, about two sets of lovers enthralled by a magic love potion in a mysterious forest. That's September 19th to 29th at the Frederick Wood Theatre. Pacific Theatre presents a staged reading of Reginald Rose's 1950s courtroom drama, 12 Angry Men. That's playing at the Pacific Theatre from September 19th to 22nd. The New BC Collective presents an eclectic program of music influenced by cultures from around the world. That's showing September 15th, tomorrow night, at 7:30 p.m. at the Good Old Chance Center for the Performing Arts. Also on Saturday night, Vancouver Pro Musica presents Persian Classical Music Ensemble Parto at 8 p.m. at the Vancouver East Cultural Center. This week in comedy, the Global Comedy Fest hits Vancouver, featuring Tommy Chong, Jeremy Hotz, David Cross, and many more. That's from September 13th to 22nd at various Vancouver venues. Anvil Press presents the launch of Salvatore Di Falco's Black Rabbit and other stories, plus readings by Matthew Firth and Dennis E. Bolin. That's September 17th at 7 p.m. at the Montmartre Cafe at 4362 Main. The Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery is showing a UBC Master of Fine Arts exhibition called Green. That runs from September 14th to October 7th. The Presentation House Gallery is showing Been Up So Long, It Looks Down to Me, a group exhibition exploring the concept of inversion. That's September 15th to November 4th at 333 Chesterfield Avenue in North Vancouver. One important movie opening this week is Across the Universe, directed by Frida director Julie Taymor and starring Evan Rachel Wood and Jim Sturgess. It's a musical romance set entirely to a Beatles soundtrack, which explores the moods and motivations of the 1960s. That's playing at the Scotiabank Theatre in Vancouver. Of course, the Vancouver Fringe Festival is also continuing this week at various Vancouver venues before closing on Sunday. If you can't quite make it out there this weekend, though, you can still catch The Pick of the Fringe, which is showing from September 20th to October 9th. Finally, don't forget that the Vancouver International Film Festival will be starting up on September 27th at the Van City Theatre, the Ridge Theatre, Pacific Cinematheque, and the Empire Granville 7 Cinemas. I'll have a review of the festival film outsourced, as well as more information on the festival next week. Thanks and have a great weekend. This is Katie Fitzpatrick for the Arts.
And thank you, Katie. I would just apologize for our previous technical difficulties. We will have Peter's piece for you a little bit later on. But right now it is 5:40, and it's time for Thunderbird Eye on Sports with Tyler Noble.
Thank you, Jeff. The UBC football team is looking to rebound after their 21-12 loss to Manitoba last Saturday as they take on the Alberta Golden Bears tomorrow at Thunderbird Stadium. The 1-1 T-Birds had their running game virtually shut down by the Bisons as banged-up running back Chris Chidsky was held to just 38 yards rushing. The Golden Bears entered the contest at 0-2 following a close 24-22 loss to Regina at home last week. Needless to say, this game is a big one for UBC as the Birds play four of their last five games on the road, including a rematch against Manitoba out in Winnipeg. Linebacker Shea Emery will dress for his second start as a Thunderbird after posting an impressive 12 tackles in his CIS debut against Manitoba. Emery on preparing for the Golden Bears.
They got a lot of different formations that we have to get used to, a lot of checks that we have to know what's going on. And basically, it's like learning a new defense every week when you got a team that does a whole bunch of different formations. So it's kind of tough, but I think we got it down.
Just as Chisky will be looking for a bounce-back game, the Birds will certainly be on the lookout for Alberta running back Tendai Jozy. The last time the two teams met was last season when Jozy ran for 176 yards and two touchdowns in a heartbreaking 18-17 loss for UBC. Birds quarterback Doug Goldsby has already proven his worth as a CIS starter, despite throwing early interceptions in both games so far this season. But the second-year pivot has been able to maintain his focus and has shown his ability to spread the ball around and scramble on his own when necessary. Goldsby's Alberta counterpart, Quade Armstrong, had a strong game last week against Regina, throwing for 255 yards and two touchdowns. UBC head coach, Ted Govaya, sees many similarities between the two teams and thinks tomorrow's matchup will be a close one.
You know, they're very athletic at the receiver position, and they've got a really good offensive line. And, on defense, they've got some experienced players in the front seven and, you know, young but athletic in the back end, in the secondary. So, you know, I think we're pretty similar that way, and it's going to be a great test for us.
Kickoff for tomorrow's game is at 2 o'clock, a game we'll have for you right here on CITR with the full one-hour pregame show beginning at 1 o'clock. After starting the regular season a perfect 2-0, the women's soccer team is back in action this weekend, hosting the University of Victoria Vikes for their home opener tomorrow afternoon. The defending national champs remain number one in the CIS standings after convincing wins over both the Regina Cougars and Manitoba Bisons last week. With UBC All-Canadian goalkeeper Jackie Dunnett still nursing a shoulder injury, forward Jill Kinsman will once again fill in between the posts. The team's new recruits have already had a big impact, as both Natalie Hirayama and Chelsea Stang scored two goals apiece last weekend. Rookie midfielder Lisa Furutani will make her Thunderbird debut tomorrow after missing out on last weekend. Victoria enters the contest with a 1-1 record after a loss to Manitoba and a 5-0 romp over Regina, in which fourth-year forward Ali Bach scored a hat trick. Kickoff is set for 12 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at Wolfson Field. The men's soccer team is also back in action this weekend and are looking for their first win of the season after a tie and loss, a draw and loss, against Calgary and Lethbridge last week. The Birds host the Fraser Valley Cascades tomorrow afternoon and then host the always challenging Trinity Western Spartans on Sunday at Thunderbird Stadium. The Birds will certainly see some lineup changes this weekend, as four subs that entered Sunday's game against Calgary had a huge impact on the game, including the tying goal from Charles Valliere. Third-year defender Graham Smith will miss at least tomorrow's match against the Cascades after receiving a red card while playing the Dinos. But fans can expect first-year midfielder Jorge Angel Mira to suit up again this weekend after an impressive impressive showing in his CIS debut, scoring UBC's first goal of the season. While the Cascades failed to win a match last season, they've already turned some heads this year with a 3-1 upset last Saturday over the defending national champion Alberta Golden Bears. The Spartans won't make any life or won't make life any easier for the Birds, rather, as they come into the weekend a perfect 2-0, shutting out both Alberta and Saskatchewan last week. Kickoff for tomorrow's match against Fraser Valley is at 2 p.m. at Lett Field, while Sunday's match against the Spartans is at Thunderbird Stadium, as I mentioned earlier, and that's also a 2 p.m. start. The women's field hockey team opens their regular season tomorrow afternoon with a two-game weekend series against the Alberta Pandas in Edmonton. The defending national champion Ladybirds will be looking for their seventh CIS title in 10 years this season and will have to do so without the help of now-graduated Christine DePape and All-Canadian Lee Sanderson. The team still possesses some great veteran leadership, however, in fifth-year two-time MVP Jesse Dennys, as well as fourth-year midfielder Tyler Flexman. Last year's starting goalie, Deb Martell, won't be returning this season, but the now-promoted Katie Graham posted a 0.80 goals against average in splitting duties last year, and that was good for third best in the conference. The Birds recently returned from a training tour in New Zealand and finished their tour with a 2-3-2 record, going up against some of the country's top club and university teams. Head coach Hash Kanji says they've learned some new things they'll try to apply, especially in terms of strengthening their mids and attack. The Canada West schedule has each team play each other at home and away for a total of 12 games. Tomorrow's match against Alberta begins at 11 a.m., with Sunday's rematch also starting at 11. The women's volleyball team doesn't open their regular season until late October, but head coach Doug Reimer's squad is already in full training mode. Monday evening, the Ladybirds host an exhibition match against the National Institute of Fitness and Sport. That's here all the way from Kanoya, Japan. The two teams have already met twice last week, with Kanoya winning both matches in four sets. Here's the Thunderbirds' Claire Hanna on the team's visit.
It was some good preseason training because we can kind of establish what our team's looking like, what we have to work on, things like that.
And Monday's tilt begins at 5 p.m. at War Memorial Gym. Finally, the men's hockey team begins their exhibition season tonight in Banff, taking on the Alberta Golden Bears in a two-game weekend set. The Birds are coming off their most successful season in 32 years, advancing to the Canada West semifinals, where they lost to the Lethbridge Pronghorns in their best-of-three series. The Birds will check that. That's actually the Alberta Golden Bears in their best-of-three series. The Birds will play a total of six preseason games before opening at home against Alberta in the newly refurbished Winter Sports Center on October 5th. And in other Thunderbird news, the Department of Athletics has released a new historical book titled Flight of the Thunderbirds by Don Wells, who is a former marketing director for UBC Athletics. The 160-page book chronicles a century of varsity sport at UBC and includes numerous historical documents and photos. The book is on sale exclusively at the UBC bookstore beginning tomorrow, which coincides with this weekend's UBC Alumni Weekend. And at tomorrow's football game, the 1982 Vanier Cup Championship football team will be honored as part of the various festivities that are going to be going on the weekend, Katie.
Thank you very much for that, Tyler. And now we'll check in with meteorologist Selena Ferris for a look at your weekend weather.
Looks like it's going to be a nice weekend. Some fog may roll in overnight, but developing high pressure in the region will ensure a sunny day on Saturday. Sunday, we'll see a mix of sun and cloud with a chance of showers throughout the day. Temperatures will remain mild, with a weekend high of 23 degrees. Early next week, we'll see a mix of sun and clouds. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
Now wait a minute. You know you make me wanna
shout, shout, let it all out.
Yo, on Tuesday, October 2nd, 2007, CITR 101.9 FM and the UBC AMS presents That DJ Competition at the Pit. And we want you to spin. So here's the download. It's quite simple. Eight DJs play 15-minute sets each with a minimum of three genres of music to keep the party popping. There are no restrictions on what audio sources or what musical style the DJ chooses to use. DJs must bring their own music and needles and provide their own transportation. The equipment provided will be properly functioning, professional, quality equipment. Interested? Then send your demo to That DJ Competition, CITR Radio, 233-6138 Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1. Along with your full name, emailing address, mailing address, home, cell phone number, your musical style, and audio sources used.
MySpace submissions are also accepted. Please send them to thatdjcompetition2007@gmail.com. For more information, please visit our website at www.citr.ca or email thatdjcompetition2007@gmail.com.
T-shirts,
well-mannered cardigans,
pants, jackets, and underwear.
The Friends of CITR card scores you discounts at Antisocial, Berku's Angels, and Hits Boutique.
Uzbekistan Prints or Rajasthan Colors.
Support CITR Radio and pick up your card today.
And welcome back to News 101. To then end off today's show on a high note, we're going to return to our foreign correspondent, Peter Otis, and we're going to look at his take on how the Danes and Canadians like to party.
At first sight, social gatherings in Denmark are awfully similar to Canada. Whether it's a birthday bash or just an informal get-together, you've got to have snacks, you've got to have music playing in the background, some beer, a couple flags. Hang on, flags? Okay, there's one huge difference between Canadian and Danish culture. If you were at someone's house in, let's say, Vancouver, and everywhere you looked you saw Canadian flags, you'd think, well, you wouldn't know what to think because, well, that sort of thing just doesn't happen. Not so in Denmark. I've quickly learned that when in the proximity of many Danish flags, a party must be underway nearby. None of the locals that I've asked have been able to explain this phenomenon to me. They've simply grown up with the association, look at me in surprise when I tell them that in Canada we don't put up flags when we party. I mean, can you just imagine the types of situations that must arise?
Man, I got so wasted last Friday night, I puked on the flag.
Whoa, man! You puked on the flag! That's badass!
Equally fascinating, at least to my foreign mind, is the myth of how the white cross on a red background came to be in the first place. The date was June 15th, 1219. It was a challenging day for the Danish army fighting in the Battle of Valdima near Tallinn, Estonia. The Estonian forces were showing full might, and the Kingdom of Denmark was on the edge of defeat. But then, the heavens opened up and down came the flag, leading the Danish kingdom to victory on that glorious day in 1219. Only now am I realizing all that a new country like Canada is missing out on. If we were to come up with a myth like that today, well, no one would believe us. I mean, let's see.
It was a cold, windy day that February 15th, 1965, when a dragon flew onto Parliament Hill.
Nah, it just doesn't have the same ring to it. The Danes have a story that beats ours any day. From the land where all the elevators say, and I'm not making this up, they say, I fart, this is Peter Otis for News 101.
First of all, I have to apologize for that very unconventional oddity, but that's Peter Otis for you. Jeff, what's your take on this?
I'm really not sure what to think. I'm sitting here listening to this piece, shaking my head, saying, oh, Peter, what have you come up with here? Well, it's very interesting. It's true. He brings up an interesting point about mythology and just the age of European nations. I mean, we just don't have that here. Interesting about the flag. I have my doubts about it just coming down from the sky, though.
Well, you're right. It is an interesting point because, I mean, take the World Cup, for instance. When you watch the World Cup, you know, the whole school gets, you know, wrapped up in a World Cup fever. Everyone cheers for their favorite countries, you know, whether maybe they're from somewhere in Africa and they cheer for Ghana, or they're from Europe and they cheer for the Ukraine or England. But in Canada, you know, we're all kind of Canadian, but we don't have any real definite heritage or, you know, affiliation to one place. We're kind of a nation, you know, as Margaret Atwood once said, we're a nation of immigrants. So it's interesting, you know, comparing it somewhere in Europe to here.
It's true. We just don't have that history. Now, he brought up this idea of a dragon on Parliament Hill. I think that's pretty neat, actually. I think that could catch on, really.
That would make some good children's books. I don't know. We would probably make a quick buck, you know? Dragon descends on Parliament Hill. Could build in Canadian legends and myths.
Well, you know, if you talk about it enough, people will believe it. It's It's not a lie if you believe it, Katie.
Are you trying to brainwash me, Jeff?
No, not at all. I'm just saying, you know, it could be done. It could. Yes, I took that one from George Costanza from Seinfeld. I can't take credit for that one. It's only a lie. Sorry, it's not a lie
if you believe it.
Yeah. But I think that's a great one to live by, seriously.
I think it is. Well, you know what? Maybe we can start something now. Maybe if we build it up enough on CITR, maybe word will get out, and sooner or later people will just start believing.
Maybe we should. I think. Now, one other thing I just got to say about this is I wonder if Peter had – he must have had to immerse himself in Danish party culture to come up with this piece. That's the only thing I can think of. So, you know, those voices he had on there, I think that's how he spent his last Saturday night.
Oh, well, it'll be definitely interesting to see what Peter's like when he comes back from Copenhagen in January. I am intrigued to see everything he's learned and what sort of Danish party culture things he brings back with him to CITR. So
it's just so easy to bash him when he's not here.
Peter, if you're listening, we still love you, and we want you to come back, but...
Please do.
Yeah. But thank you very much for your lovely weekly segment.
And bring some flags with you when you do return, Peter.
Yeah, maybe we should string up some Canadian flags in the control room. I think that'd be a nice touch.
I think so. Kind of brighten up the place a little bit.
Agreed.
It's a fine idea. All right, well, that's our program for today, September 14th, 2007. 2007, pardon me. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca.
Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Jeff Sargent. Thanks for listening. Coming up next is The Canadian Way. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
DJ Lee, oh. Thursday evening, 7:30 to 9.